From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 6th day of June, 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll hear about a FarmDoc daily survey done of MAHA, or Make America Healthy Again, and some of the surprising results from that survey. And then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass as we wrap up our first half hour of the program today. If you can stay with us for the whole of the hour, you'll hear not only the Closing Market Report, but also Commodity Week. Otherwise, it's up online right now at WILLAG.org with our panelists, including Matt Bennett, Aaron Curtis, and Ellen Dearden, all on this Friday edition of the Ag Programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
July corn for the day settled at 442 and a half. It was up 3. September at 433 and a quarter, a penny and three quarters higher. December up 1 on this Friday at 449 and a quarter. July beans settled 5 and a half higher at $10.57 and a quarter. November at 1037, 3 and three quarters higher. Bean meal down $1.40. The bean oil 85 cents higher for the day. July soft red winter wheat up 9 and a quarter cents. It settled at 554 and three quarters, and the hard red at 549. 9 and a quarter, up 6 and three quarters of a cent for the day. Live cattle futures in Chicago at 218, 87 and a half, up $2, and a nickel. Feeders a dollar higher, and lean hogs up 230. Mike Zuzulo's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Hello, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Todd. Thanks for having me.
What were the most important things in your mind about the commodity markets this week?
Two things. You know, why did the soybeans rally and break free from the 2018 price action that we had kind of set in stone last Friday at this time with both price and time? And I think the simple answer was because President Trump picked up the phone and called President Xi, and they're talking specifically about rare earths and talking specifically about Chinese students getting visas, really helped soothe the mindset of the trade, the sentiment of the trade. And so we went back to more of a friendly bean price action. And one of the things we've noticed here, Todd, in the last several months since the fears of a trade war have become increasing is that as the trade fears increase, we see the dollar go down, the gold go up, wheat and corn tend to be bought against the soybeans. And then when we go to the opposite of that and trade fears wane and sentiment improves that we're coming back around, we see soybeans find a lot of buying and a lot of support at the expense of the dollar and typically at the expense of the wheat and at the corn. Now, this week was a little bit different, which I was glad to see, in that there is more geopolitical risk put into the WTI crude oil and the wheat, less demand risk to the downside that has been serving as a brake to both of those commodities. That's a really key element, I think, as we come back into next week's trade, because we are seeing that counter-seasonal move in the wheat market as of Friday's close, with us making a new monthly high and only about a penny away from taking out the May high in the wheat. So we see the soybeans making new monthly highs, going after that 1075 May high is the next resistance. And we see the wheat doing the same thing, but for different reasons. And I kind of like that they're finding their support from different areas. One thing I did not like this week was the corn market finding a lot of resistance in the July, and that July D's corn spread going back to a carrying charge and hitting about a 10-month low on Thursday. That was matched on Friday, but we were able to get back up a little bit more premium and take ourselves off the floor to close 6 or 7 cents discount the July or back to a carrying charge against the December futures.
So you are of the opinion that wheat is finding support geopolitically. Is it also finding any support from the idea that the rainfall across the Southwest, Kansas, as well as through parts of Missouri and Illinois, so hard red and soft red, both, that might cause a disease issue at some point or a harvest problem?
I think that'll come the next couple weeks. I think what the trade is looking at in the wheat specifically is what we talked about last week with China and the whole Northern Hemisphere, essentially, whether you're looking at the United States or looking more closely at the Black Sea and even more closely at the Chinese wheat belt, with harvest starting over there, actually coming in early in provinces that represent almost 50, almost 60% of their typical wheat production. And that's getting a lot of press this week. Bloomberg had an article, I think it was midweek, talking about some private analysts, I believe in China, that didn't want to go on the record, but said that they could be looking at 5 to 7 year lows in production. That's big news when you're talking about the world's largest wheat producer. Even if they'd have ample stocks and don't want to import more from the United States, it still could take quite a bit off the balance sheets and I think make the market take notice. And I'm really glad this is happening this week, because then we get ready for the big WASDE report on the 12th. And that's going to be one of the keys to be watching, I think.
Yeah. So you're thinking this is supply driven and that it may very well show up in the global numbers that the World Ag Outlook Board puts together for Thursday of next week.
That's exactly right. I think that, you know, the idea of the less demand risk that I was talking about a minute ago, that's been serving as a break in terms of the funds wanting, I think, to buy in or cover shorts in their big net short position in perceived demand. And so this really could change the dynamic as far as perceived demand by the funds if we see both Russia and China have a crop that's on the low end of the five-year range or even below the five-year average or five-year range. And I think both of those countries are on tap for that if they don't see a big pattern shift really, really soon.
Historically, you like to see wheat lead the marketplace. Do you believe that's where we're headed at this point?
I really have to, Todd, because of our weather here in this country coming around pretty nicely. Having said that, you know, Illinois's got the good to excellent crop conditions of 67%. I believe that's the second worst or the worst in 5 years. We've got other states like Nebraska and South Dakota and Ohio that are in that camp as well, or close to that situation as well. So, I mean, we're not out of the woods, but we, I think, have dodged a major 2012 type scenario, at least this first go round, right at planting and right after planting. So, yeah, when I look at the global picture and the U.S. picture, it seems to me wheat needs to be the leader to the upside here.
Tell me a little bit about, as we close out our time together, and we've got a minute and a half, the livestock sector and the cattle market this week.
Yeah, great thing you brought up. I started hedges on Friday for Q2 and Q3 with my producers. Recommendations to go ahead and get some hedges in place with known cost puts, just like soybeans, getting a floor underneath me, because I think we're trading the screwworm border shutdown in real time through these escalating cash prices. But I also think we've got some potential real sinkholes or pitfalls ahead of us in terms of Wall Street and in terms of when that border does open. I think you'll see the funds take a lot of profit off the table, and we're getting really rich in the cycle. The cycle peak has passed us, and so we really need to feed the bull. So I think these record highs are meant to be sold in a very conservative, known cost manner, very respectful manner, kind of like the soybeans. And if we get past the next 30, 45 days without finding any pitfalls, that's great.
Thank you much, Mike. I appreciate it.
You too, Todd. Thank you.
That's Mike Zuzulow. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. There are a couple of new articles that have been posted to the FarmDoc Daily website that deal with MAHA, or the Make America Healthy Again initiative. They're penned by Jonathan Kappas and Maria Kalatzantanikis from the University of Illinois, along with Brenna Ellison at Purdue University. Maria joined me to talk about these two articles. I asked why it is that they did the survey.
With the Gardner Food and Ag Policy Survey, we tried to assess and then track public support and public perceptions of ongoing food and ag issues. So this wave, which was conducted in May, we asked about support for the Make America Healthy Again initiative. And then we, in the last two investigations on FarmDoc, we sort of dove into who was more likely to support the Make America Healthy Again initiative, and then also what were their perceptions of the food system. So did they believe the food system was safe? And then also, did they trust different food system players? So that's farmers, grocery stores, government, that sort of thing.
What are some of the key takeaways?
One thing that was really interesting to me was we looked at who was most likely to support Make America Healthy Again initiative. So we found that political ideology, unsurprisingly, was quite predictive of support. So if you were very conservative, or if you had voted for President Trump in the 2024 presidential election, you were much more likely to support MAHA. But also food system experiences were quite tied to it as well. So things like if you had gone to the farmer's market in the last 2 weeks, that was associated with an increased likelihood to support MAHA. Whereas if you had personal or familial experiences in agriculture, so, you know, do you own a farm or does someone in your immediate family own a farm? If you are living in a rural area or if you utilize nutrition assistance programs, so things like SNAP or WIC, all of those things decreased your likelihood to support MAHA. And then sort of relatedly, although we've been hearing a lot of news about the focus on like the MAHA moms, we didn't find a relationship between gender or having children that increased somebody's likelihood to support MAHA. So it was sort of an interesting thing to look at to understand sort of like who was most likely to support MAHA. We also found sort of some interesting perspectives that very conservative and conservatives were more likely to support MAHA, but also people who were very liberal sort of had higher rates of supporting MAHA. And then I don't know if you want to talk about perceptions of food safety or trust, but there were some really interesting results there as well.
Let's take those up. What did your survey find?
I was expecting to see sort of what I've heard echoed in news stories lately, which is that MAHA supporters are broadly think of the food system as being unsafe or broadly untrusting of food system players. And I think basically what we found is that while they broadly are not concerned about safety in, of the food system, or the, while they're broadly not untrusting of all food system players, they have specific concerns. So for example, food additives or firm sizes, right, that sort of come out. And I think also when we're hearing in the news about Make America Healthy Again supporters, we're hearing from the loudest voices, the leaders of the initiative. In our study, obviously, we're looking at sort of the average consumer in the U.S. So maybe their level of concern is different than sort of the leaders of an initiative, if that makes sense.
On the average consumer side, the middle was less supportive of MAHA and less trusting of the food system?
Yes.
Did they say why?
No, they did not say why. That is an interesting question for the future. Definitely part of what we saw was that the middle was also just less informed. So the middle was less likely to also know about MAHA. So part of it may be too that if you are very liberal and or you are very conservative, you are sort of more plugged into the discussion about the changes going on with MAHA.
Can you infer anything about their reasons for not being trustful of the system?
Maybe I should clarify slightly. So what I was surprised by was that Make America Healthy Again supporters did not have a lower level of trust in food system players than others. But it's not, they have pretty similar levels. So for example, you can look at figure one in the post two. And you can see that, for example, on a scale of one, do not trust, to a seven, trust very much, MAHA supporters had a 5.9 for farmers. And those who were either a negative view of MAHA or unaware of MAHA had a rating of 5.5. So these are not enormous differences. What I'm surprised by, I suppose, is that the supporters of MAHA were not more untrusting, given the way that they've been depicted broadly. What our work suggests is that MAHA supporters are not broadly untrusting of the food system, and similarly, they are not broadly concerned about the safety of the food that's being produced in the U.S. They more so are having specific issues. So the two that we sort of highlight in our work is that they have concerns about food additives, which has been central to the discussion of MAHA, and then also about the size of firms in the food system.
I'm looking forward to what you've got coming up. What's next for this series? Anything?
Yeah, so the Gardner Food and Ag Policy Survey continues to track, you know, perceptions of trust in the food system, perceptions of safety, and I'm sure that these things will continue to evolve. But we also respond to ongoing things, so MAHA definitely isn't going anywhere, and we'll be continuing to keep our eye on that.
That's Maria Kalitsyn-Donenkis from the University of Illinois. She and Jonathan Kappas, her colleague here on campus, along with Brenna Ellison from Purdue University, have written a couple of articles to this date about MAHA, or the Make America Healthy Again initiative. You can read it online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Let's turn our attention to the weather forecast now. Eric Snodgrass is here. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions in Dagobel. Hello, Eric. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm actually glad to be on because I'll tell you something, Todd. Yesterday, I was in the Imperial Valley in California. So if you don't know where that is, that's like near the Salton Lake. That's way down south. In fact, I drove past Trump's wall yesterday. It was pretty interesting to see that. But where I was, it was crazy. While you all were getting rain here, all right, I was sitting in the middle of a desert at about 108 degrees. And I'll be honest with you, I don't care when people say, oh, it's a dry heat. It's hot. And then I was amazed at one thing. I go up and talk to these farmers that were there. And while it was storming at home, I looked at the data around central Illinois. And there were some places in central Illinois over the last, 48 hours that had twice as much as the annual rainfall that I saw in the Imperial Valley in Southern California. But they are all irrigated. It's all coming off the Colorado River. And it's a very interesting place. But last night as I drove home, we got diverted because of huge storms that were in the plains again. And that just really kind of tells you where the moisture's been and where it's not been. And boy, the rain that came through here, we did need. I get home and now I'm just looking at grass that needs cut again and wondering when the next rain chances are.
Coming off the Colorado River must be one of the last places because it doesn't really most of the time actually reached the Pacific Ocean, if I remember correctly. It just is all used up by the time it gets there.
It is. And I'll be honest with you, when you go to that part of the world and talk water, you tread lightly. I'll be honest, Todd, I show them, I said, well, where I am, more often than not, we're trying to manage water on the side of it as get rid of it. It's too much. We have often have a problem where we're dealing with too much water at times. And it was interesting just to show them the differences between the Midwest and the Southwestern United States. But don't forget, California leads the country in the production of over 40 different fruits and vegetables. And this is what's crazy. That part of California that I was in, a big crop is hay, and they will get 10 cuttings a year. So
wow.
Incredible. Yeah, that's what it's like in Southern California.
Three here if we're good, four if we're really good. That is amazing. This all reminds me that you and I both like to listen to Audible books, and we have both listened to Where the Water Goes by David Owen, a great, great book. If you want to know about the Colorado River, again, the name of the book is Where the Water Goes. I think you and I would both recommend it. Now, Professor, I have forgotten if you could remind me, what's my lesson plan that I'm supposed to be following up on?
Yeah, well, it's mainly just come to class right now, Todd. That's what I think I want you to do.
Okay.
So here it is. We do have a chance of rain this weekend, and we've seen these cooler temperatures around, right? So we are, if you planted a crop, I'm just going to pull a date out because I just looked at it. But if you planted last year on April 15th, and then you planted this year on April 15th, you compare the GDDs, we had over 750 GDDs by a year ago. And right now we're sitting at about 600, right around where we are. And as a result, we got a crop that just looks like it needs to jump out of the ground. We have not had the heat. And so we have to balance that against this narrative of, oh, there was supposed to be risk of summer hot, dry conditions. And remember, it's not yet summer, so we still have time for that to go through. So we're about 15 days into this 45-day assignment of watching the ocean temperatures in the kind of Gulf of Alaska area. They're still cold off the coast of California, which, by the way, when you're in San Diego, it was barely out of the upper 60s. You go over the mountains and it's 110, so that's how it is in Southern California. But the water off the coast there is still cool. And if we see any hint of cooling in the Gulf of Alaska, which it is not doing today, then that starts to increase our drought risk as the Bermuda High wanders off in the Atlantic. They're kind of related systems. So here we stand with incredibly wet conditions to our south continuing, big storms to our south, three more days of severe weather, I mean, from Texas all the way to the East Coast, but to our south. And after we get this weekend rain, we're going to slide into a drier time period with the driest conditions over the next 2 weeks really being in Iowa. Now, those Iowan farmers are not going to complain about this for a while because they're going to get some heat on the crop. They've had some halfway decent rains recently. But I think if we manage to stretch this out really for 2 weeks at the end of that, they're going to be calling for, hey, what's going on? Are we really going over toward hotter and drier? And right now, there are some hints that that could happen in the Western Corn Belt, which has been the area we've been worried about. So that's kind of my near-term outlook, Todd.
If we get out 2 weeks, we will be one day or maybe right at the beginning of summer, although meteorological summer probably started June 1, but we'll begin, we'll be that point where we are in summer. Are there any new outlooks that we need to discuss today?
There are, and it's interesting that that this came out this way, but the new European seasonal forecast came out for summer, which I'm just going to call July, August, and September. Those are our hottest months. And Todd, it's trying to plant dryness west of the Mississippi. I mean, quite a bit of it. And it's trying to put heat there too. And it's also trying to do that same combination in the Black Sea while northern China seems to be wet, while India seems to be wet. And I look at all of this and go, where's the forcing that's creating that? And what do we need to see happen? And I'll just put it to you like this. If that's going to be the case, we've got to lose a lot of momentum in the jet stream between now and the end of this month. Secondly, we've got to watch the ocean temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska cool off. That would be a complement to that. And thirdly, the combination of those two events gives us a Bermuda high that leaves the southeast coast of the United States where it's been. That's what's been pumping in all this moisture. And it wanders off into the North Atlantic. And if any of those things happen, that's another part of your assignment for the rest of this month. If any of those things happen, or if I start professing they're happening, then we've got a problem. Like that's going to be a midsummer pattern flip, and it could produce some regional drought. But let me just give you some numbers here to finish this up.
Okay.
Preseason, I was worried of the Western Corn Belt at 60% risk of drought. I gave you that number. I reran those odds based on what we now know has happened in the Southern Plains and the Mid-South with all that rain and the rain that's coming. And that has reduced the drought risk kind of in a central area around Iowa specifically to 45%. Okay. But the historical odds of building drought from now through summer in Iowa are still at about 30%. So what's the moral of the story? We're down. We're down from where the original projections were, but we are still above the historical average on risk of building drought into that area, which is what we're going to have to continue to monitor. So there it is, Todd. That's the new evidence. And when we talk next Friday, I'll even have more model data to share with you and possibly toss in some analog years to think through as well.
Excellent. Hey, thank you much.
You bet.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions, and Agrible joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.